The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Cindy Fowler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Raleigh News and Observer, the National Gardening Association e-newsletter, Dave's Garden e-newsletter, the Triangle Gardener magazine, and maybe from Jerry Baker's terrific garden tonics. We'll start with the Raleigh News and Observer. This article is by Norman Winter, titled Vermilionaire Cuppia, a must-have plant for birds and butterflies. 3 years ago, I wrote an article on cuppias and merely gave casual mention to a variety called Vermilionaire, which we have been growing for a year. Now, after growing 3 more years, including 7 at my home on a rocky red clay hillside in West Georgia, I can say this is a must-have plant. When I say must-have, you may be thinking that is a pretty strong recommendation. Now, in late July, my plants are about 24 inches tall, 36 inches wide. The orange-red tubular flowers are non-stop and produced by the hundreds on each plant. There are always 5 or 6 hummingbirds on them, leaving occasionally to go hit on my giant Amistad salvia. The bees are there in great numbers, too, and every once in a while appear to challenge a hummingbird. This usually ends up with the hummer quickly showing who's boss. The thing that has surprised me most, however, are the butterflies. Every day there are spicebush swallowtails, eastern tiger swallowtails, and even pearl crescents. This is truly a plant for anyone that enjoys the pollinator garden. I have mine intermingle with milkweeds and the new misty blue salvia. The combination has been very pleasing and really successful. My son, who I sometimes consider the adventurous color designer, uses them in large containers with lime green ornamental sweet potato vines and even calabacas. He uses them at outdoor shopping centers where the clientele is often stunned at seeing hummingbirds at the mall. Botanically speaking, Vermilionaire is a Cuppia ignea hybrid. It develops into a woody-like plant, and as I said, bearing hundreds of scarlet orange flowers for months. In zones 8 and 9, it will get knocked to the ground by freezes, but normally returns faithfully in the spring, provided it does not sit in water during the cold winter. Believe me, it is being grown in colder areas as an annual, much like you would a petunia. When you locate your Vermilionaire cuppias, buy at least 3. Select a site in full sun and plant in well-drained soil. Set plants 24 to 36 inches apart, planting at the same depth they are growing in the container. Apply a good layer of mulch, water to get established, and then enjoy. In early summer, pinch growth as needed, and more branching will follow. My son does this religiously, while I have a tendency to leave them natural. Both methods have proven very successful. Feed in midsummer and again in early fall with a light application of a balanced, slow-release fertilizer. These species are drought-tolerant, but watering during prolonged dry periods will pay dividends in the fall. Use them informally in the garden rather than lined up like soldiers. They work well with other hummingbird plants, like the firebush or planted in partnership with Chapel Hill Yellow Lantana and Gold Star Esperanza. Blue flowers, whether round or spiky, create partnerships that you will want to photograph as much as the hummingbirds. A lot of hot weather remains, and Vermilionaire cuppies would make a fine addition to your garden. And now, from Dave's Garden e-newsletter, Tomato History and Hearsay by Audrey Stahlsmith. Where did the tomato come from? Although few of us today can imagine a world without tomatoes, Solanum lycopersicum, those fruits didn't become a staple of the American diet until the end of the 19th century. During the Civil War, there had been a large demand for canned victuals to feed the soldiers, and tomatoes fit right into those tins. They fit right in. By the conclusion of the 1800s, the fruit had become popular enough that a certain Campbell sold it as soup. However, the tomato had not gained its acceptance easily. It probably originated in the mountains of western South America, only to be ignored by the natives there. At some point, the plant was carried north to Central America and Mexico, where the Aztecs recognized its potential. Since they already grew the somewhat similar fruit, now called the tomatilla, then named tomato, they probably assumed that the new one, which they dubbed tomato, XITOMATL, must be edible too. The conquistadors eventually would take it to Spain, from whence it spread to other parts of Europe. In 1544, Italian herbalist Pietro Mattioli described the fruits as yellow. We can hazard that the original wild variety may have been a two-celled type, similar to our cherry tomatoes. We have a yellow one of those that occasionally reseeds itself in the garden. It certainly is tougher and more disease-resistant than most of the others we grow, so perhaps it harks back to the original. Although Italians adopted the newcomer almost immediately, the tomato was viewed with suspicion in England. It had somehow become associated with the mandrake, which, although considered an aphrodisiac, also could be dangerously toxic. So tomatoes, too, became known as love apples. In the late 1500s, John Gerard wrote that they yield very little nourishment to the body and the same not and corrupt. It's possible that tomatoes actually could have sickened the wealthy who ate off of pewter plates, since the acid in the fruits may have activated the lead in that pewter. But in that case, it would have been the dinnerware, not the dinner, that was at fault. Still, any member of the deadly nightshade family had to be viewed with suspicion until it proved itself. I recall once reading a clever short story where a traitorous cook tried to poison George Washington with tomatoes in his stew and couldn't understand why the general remained unaffected. But the tomato actually was grown by venturesome American gardeners, including Thomas Jefferson, in the 1700s. So it probably just wasn't well known enough for most people to be comfortable with eating it. Those weird horned green worms that attack the plants didn't help, as they sometimes were assumed to be venomous. Legend holds that in 1920, a Colonel Robert Gibbon Johnson proposed to consume a basket of tomatoes on the steps of the local courthouse in Salem, New Jersey, just to prove they were edible. Although the idea of crowds of spectators gathering in hopes of witnessing his death throes makes a good story, but a depressing comment on human nature. It most likely is just a story. Granted, there was a Colonel Robert Gibbon Johnson thereabouts at that time. But, as Andrew Smith points out in The Tomato in America, neither the local newspaper nor Johnson's own writings make any mention of such an event. The tomato has since caught on in a big way, but you may still argue with your kin about whether it is a fruit or vegetable. A tomato technically is a fruit, but in 1893, the Supreme Court pronounced it a vegetable so it could be taxed. Therefore, all of you are right. Next, from the National Gardening Association e-newsletter, All About Rosemary by Carol Seville. How to grow rosemary. Rosemary and its cultivars are best started from plants. When grown from seed, germination is slow with variable results. Plants can be set out in the spring when the weather has warmed in zones 1 through 9. All rosemaries require full sun, but in the warmer climates they will accept some light shade. They thrive in a light, well-drained, average garden soil with a pH range of 5 to 8. During the growing season, pinch back growth tips 2 or 3 inches to promote bushy plants. Cut back hard only in early spring to allow the new growth time to mature. Rosemary means dew of the sea, an appropriate name for this popular garden herb, watered by the ocean mists in its native habitat along the arid coastline of the Mediterranean. Because of rosemary's long history, literary, cosmetic, culinary, and medicinal, an herb garden without rosemary is unthinkable. But this versatile evergreen needn't be relegated only to the herb garden. Rosemary forms extraordinary hedges and can be clipped into fancy topiary, even bonsai for those with the patience, says landscape designer Rosalind Creasy. It's a gleaming focal point in the perennial garden, or mixed border, she adds. Rosemary is a must in the fragrance garden and the cornerstone of a drought-tolerant garden. A selection of rosemaries. Rosmarinus officinalis is the classic culinary upright rosemary with opposite needle-like gray-green leaves that are 1/2 to 1.5 inches long with powdery white undersides. The plant bears 2-lipped pale blue flowers in little clusters toward the end of the branches. This evergreen shrub grows 3 to 5 feet tall. Majorca pink is from the Balearic Islands in the Spanish Mediterranean. Similar in growth to the Rosmarinus officinalis, it has shorter, resinous leaves and lovely pink flowers. Planted next to one of the blue-flowering varieties, its amethyst pink flowers stand out vividly. Tuscan blue is a tall-growing, upright rosemary with branches that can reach 6 feet tall that grow dramatically from the base of the plant. Used for hedges to border small fields in Tuscany, Tuscan blue is a handsome plant with exceptionally dark blue flower spikes and highly aromatic pale green leaves that lend themselves to cooking and drying. Along with the other tall rosemaries, it is more suitable for growing in warmer climates, but it can also be grown in short season regions. Miss Jessup's Upright is named after the English gardener Miss Euphemia Jessup. In 1957, a cutting from a plant growing at Sissinghurst Castle was propagated by the plant's woman, Elizabeth DeForest, in her Santa Barbara, California garden, and then introduced into the nursery trade. It can grow from 5 to 8 feet tall and has slate blue flowers and highly aromatic dark gray-green leaves. ARP is the introduction of the distinguished plants woman, garden author, and herb aficionado, Madeline Hill of Round Top, Texas. In 1987, she discovered an extremely hardy rosemary growing in the hamlet of ARP in northeast Texas. She introduced ARP into the nursery trade via the National Herb Garden in Washington, D.C., along with another cold hardy rosemary, Hill Hardy, one of the hardiest rosemaries, surviving winter with protection to Zone 6. ARP grows from 3 to 5 feet tall, has light blue to almost white flowers, and has thick, widely spaced, fragrant leaves. It requires excellent drainage. Prostratus grows 1 to 2 feet tall and 3 to 8 feet wide, with 3/4 inch glossy, dark green leaves that have a mild, piney fragrance. The flowers are a delicate lavender blue. Another excellent prostrate rosemary is the vigorous grower and bloomer Lockwood DeForest, a California cultivar introduced from a seedling discovered in the Santa Barbara garden of the DeForest family in the 1940s. It has lighter leaves and deeper blue flowers than Prostratus. And finally, R. officinalis angustifolius, pine-scented rosemary, is from Corsica and is not considered culinary. It smells like a Christmas tree and grows as tall as a small one, from 2.5 to 4 feet, with slender, needle-shaped leaves and dark blue flowers. A choice cultivar is Benenden Blue, a semi-prostrate shrub that grows to 3 feet tall with a curious growth habit. Its initially erect branches arch and then begin to gracefully grow sideways. Now from the Triangle Gardener magazine, The Perils in the Garden by Kit Flynn. During my gardening career, I have suffered from 150 yellow jacket stings, stepped on a copperhead, and been gouged by a tetrapenic stump. After experiencing the latter, I began to wonder if the garden were trying to kill me. Now, this is not a feel-sorry article. Rather, it's about treating the garden and Mother Nature with some respect. Typically, we begin to regard our garden as a magical piece of Eden, forgetting that there was also a tree of knowledge with enticing apples, Gradually, we discover that the garden also contains some pitfalls. We want bees and wasps, just as we treasure all our pollinators. Without pollinators, our gardens would not be gardens. However, the wasps we call yellow jackets pose an occasional problem in the garden because their nests are underground. Step inadvertently on the ground entrance, and you will suddenly be aware of the nest's existence. One false step causes an army of yellow jacket warriors to come out to defend their turf. Depending upon the location of the nest, it can be hard to live in harmony with the yellow jackets. Once, their nest was in the middle of one of my two grassy areas, which meant anyone cutting the grass was subjected to an attack. Once the nest was located at the edge of the perennial border, a location hard to avoid. Now I believe in peaceful coexistence, but sometimes it's impossible to live with these aggressive warriors who will follow you, repeatedly stinging you if you are tactless enough to intrude on their territory. In this case, I have had to resort to chemical warfare, something I am not proud of, but I can only sustain so many stings. The Copperhead story went like this. I was peacefully walking over a mulched area when I realized I had stepped on something. I looked down to see a copperhead that was as horrified as I was. I went in one direction and it went in the other. Why hadn't I seen it? It was perfected camouflaged against the pine bark mulch. In the heat of the summer, my neighbor has discovered that the copperheads like to find refuge in her pots. Copperheads will also dig under my cement pavement in an effort to be cool. All that is not said to scare, but to state that vigilance is required. Stumps on the ground and stubs in shrubs can be a problem. I ran into a small tetrapanic stump when I moved the wrong way. I didn't trip or fall on it, but my foot slipped and the stump gouged me. Likewise, it's easy to pass by a spirea closely without seeing the stub sticking out about 4 inches, a stub that can gore you if you don't see it. For this reason, it is important to prune dead branches and those dead rose canes that can be covered up in the height of the growing season. For protection, I advocate wearing long pants while gardening. It's better to have that rose cane make a hole in your pants than on your skin. Always wear good, sturdy shoes to garden. Flip-flops will give you little protection should you inadvertently step on a yellow jacket nest or a snake. As a rose gardener, I always advocate gardening with a good pair of gardening gloves. Above all, make sure your tetanus shot is up to date, once every 10 years. None of this is meant to scare. Rather, it behooves us to have respect for the garden and Mother Nature. We are all intertwined, but sometimes we have to protect ourselves from that tree of knowledge. And there's a garden event coming up, a fairy garden make and take, August the 25th at 10:30 a.m. Learn how to make a fairy garden and make one to take home. The workshop is free with plants, containers, and super cute accessories available for purchase. And it's free. Register at denise@homewoodnursery.com or call 919-847-0117. 919-847-0117. This will happen at Homewood Nursery and Garden Center in Raleigh. And an introduction to botanical art and illustration, August 25th, 1 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. This class explores the history of botanical illustration, shows examples of various types of botanical illustrations and botanical art, describes the coursework for the certificate in botanical art and illustration, and introduces the instructors, supply fee included. There is a fee. And you need to pre-register by calling 919-962-0522. 919-962-0522. This happens at the North Carolina Botanical Garden, located in Chapel Hill. And now from Jerry Baker's terrific garden tonics. Here's a fall vegetable garden tonic. Once Jack Frost has called a halt to the growing season, cover your vegetable garden beds with a mixture of shredded leaves and grass clippings and treat them to a taste of this tonic. The ingredients: 1 can of regular soda, not diet, 1 cup of dishwashing liquid, and 1/4 cup of ammonia, and warm water. Instructions: mix the cola, dishwashing liquid, and ammonia in a 20-gallon hose-end sprayer, filling the balance of the jar with warm water. Saturate the layer of mulch that's on top of the soil to give your garden a good bedtime snack. And the manure cure. To my mind, there's nothing like a good old barnyard manure to keep veggie garden soil in super shape. Fresh manure can burn tender roots, so you should always cure it before you add it to your soil. Here's how I make mine cool, weed-free, and, believe it or not, almost odor-free. Step 1. Spread a big tarpaulin on the ground. Dump the manure on top. Fold up the edges of the tarp around the pile of manure. Step 2. Lay another tarp across the top and add a few rocks so that it stays put. Cut 3 or 4 slits in that tarp so the heat can get out. Step 3. Let it set for 6 months or so, and presto! You've got the best food a garden could ever ask for. And making sense. Don't go to great expense buying frost protectors for your veggies. Old lampshades will do the trick. Remove the fabric, set the wire frame over the plant, and drape a piece of old sheet or a plastic garbage bag over it. Voila! We've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Cindy Fowler, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until the next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.